support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Thank you. WBAI, New York. It's 6 a.m. Coming up next, The Morning Show, Wednesday edition.
In the morning, when the moon is at its rest, you will find me at the time I love the best, watching rainbows play on sunlight, pools of water, ice cream, cold nights in the morning. Can't you imagine it? It's the morning of my life, yeah. In the daytime, I will meet you as before. You will find me waiting by the ocean floor, building castles in the shifting sands, in a world nobody understands. In the morning, tis the morning of my life, tis the morning of my life.
Ushered in with Nina Simone. Well, I'm Mimi Rosenberg with the Wednesday edition of WBAI's Morning Shows. This morning, 40 years of imprisonment, 40 years of injustice. Attorneys seek clemency for indigenous activist Leonard Peltier from President Obama. Then, how the heck did we wind up with the Electoral College anyway? And are better elections possible? We'll find out. In the 7 o'clock hour, can Amway billionaire Betsy DeVos, Donald Trump's nominee for the position of Secretary of Education, can she change the landscape of public education in favor of Kentucky Fried Children being churned out of a privatized, commercialized system? Then the Black is Back Coalition says it won't allow MLK's birthday to be used as a celebration for the inauguration of Trump and issues a call for African people to unite and converge on Washington, D.C. for a Black agenda for self-determination. Then, after 32 years in prison, the calls grow for President Obama to release Puerto Rican activist Oscar Lopez Rivera. But first, Wednesday edition's news headlines from the Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service daily newscast for Wednesday, December 21st, 2016. I'm Mary Sherman. Today's rundown covers a variety of topics, including heightened security in the states after deadly attacks overseas, parts of the Atlantic and Alaska now off limits to oil drilling, and children's groups warn of dire consequences of a quick Obamacare repeal. Our top story, cities across the U.S. are heightening security after a deadly series of incidents abroad. Additional police officers are being deployed in New York and Chicago, with emphasis on crowded public areas and holiday gatherings. Both cities cautioned that the increased presence of law enforcement was a preventive measure and that no specific threats were received. Monday night, 11 people were killed in Berlin after a truck plowed through a Christmas market. Earlier in the day, the Russian ambassador to Turkey was assassinated, and 3 people were wounded after a gunman opened fire at an Islamic center in Switzerland. Nearly 30 people were killed and dozens injured after an explosion ripped through a popular fireworks market in Mexico. The market is said to be especially busy during the Christmas season. 2 previous explosions, which also destroyed the market, happened leading up to Independence Day celebrations. President Barack Obama will use his executive authority to permanently block offshore drilling in large swaths of the Arctic and Atlantic oceans. Likewise, neighboring Canada will halt oil and gas exploration in its own Arctic waters, according to a joint statement from Obama and Canada's prime minister. A White House spokesman said the president's action recognizes the unique ecological value in these areas. The withdrawal includes 115 million acres in the Arctic and 3.8 million acres in the North and Mid-Atlantic Ocean. All they want for Christmas is to keep their families together. That's the message dozens of Florida kids hope to send to their elected leaders today as they plead for an end to deportations. The story from Mona Shand.
In Miami, 17-year-old Elena Marquez says she hasn't seen her father in person in 4 years, since he was deported after being pulled over for driving with an expired license. Marquez says she's speaking out because she can't stand the thought of other families being torn apart that way.
It's not just about myself, but it's also about the other people who have been in the same situation as I have, or maybe even worse, because I may not know their story, but I know that we all suffer the same.
Instead of writing lists for presents or holiday cards, Marquez and close to 100 other children of undocumented immigrants from the Miami area have written letters to Mayor Carlos Jimenez, calling on him to protect their families as their only holiday wish. Those letters are being delivered to his office today.
A former spokesman to Hillary Clinton's campaign blasted the FBI Tuesday after the public release of a warrant used during the agency's investigation into Clinton's use of a private email server while Secretary of State. Clinton campaign spokesman Brian Fallon says the document showed that the FBI's intrusion on the election was utterly unjustified. The warrant shows that investigators believe there was probable cause that a laptop seized as part of an investigation contained classified information pertinent to its then-closed probe into Clinton's server, but the document provided few specifics. The risk of child abuse and neglect could rise if Congress repeals the Affordable Care Act without immediately replacing it. That's the warning today by a coalition of children's advocates in Arizona.
The groups point to a recent statement by Governor Doug Ducey that a rushed repeal would mean massive cuts to Medicaid, with up to 600,000 Arizonans losing coverage. Becky Ruffner with the group Prevent Child Abuse Arizona says it would be a huge setback for families caught up in the foster care system.
Without our Medicaid expansion, those parents would not be eligible for any kind of substance abuse treatment, mental health counseling to get back on track and get their children back. So children would be left in foster care for longer periods.
Arizona cares for 17,000 foster children at any given time. President-elect Trump, concerned about premium hikes and the individual insurance mandate, has vowed to repeal the ACA right away, but hasn't proposed a specific plan to replace it. At the Capitol today, groups are pressing Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake to insist on a replacement before any repeal. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Charges were announced Tuesday against two former state of Michigan emergency managers with multiple 20-year felonies for their failure to protect the citizens of Flint from health hazards caused by contaminated drinking water. Two former Flint workers also face felony charges of false pretenses and conspiracy to commit false pretenses. Before Tuesday, 9 people, including 8 low- and mid-level state workers and an employee of Flint's water plant, had been charged in the water crisis, which has been linked to the lead poisoning of Flint children and the deaths of 12 people from Legionnaire's disease. A company that started as a class project for 2 college students has expanded into a community service effort for more than 12,000 students at nearly 800 college campuses across the country. We get more from Veronica Carter.
Zachary Quinn and Brian Keller were students at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul when they launched Love Your Melon. The idea was to provide beanies and baseball caps for local children with cancer, but it was so successful they started a company with half of the profits going to pediatric cancer research. Spokesman Alex Meisman says college students go to hospitals dressed up in superhero costumes to deliver the caps to the kids.
And then they get to bring them in and, you know, go room to room, do arts and crafts with the kids. I mean, this can go from having a little music show or some kind of play all the way up to having a celebrity come in and perform for these kids.
In the last 4 years, Love Your Melon has provided more than 86,000 hats to children with cancer and raised more than $1.5 million for cancer research. The beanies are made by Minnesota Knitting Mills, and the baseball caps are made in Denver.
I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service. Member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Oh, Leonard Tatewikuwa. Our hearts are beating with hope. Thoughts of love are with you. We pray for Tatewikuwa, the rainbow warrior. May you live in freedom and dignity. Mother Earth beneath and Father Sky above you. Leonard, keep up the spirit of the Red Road. Strength and peace, love and happiness. Light will shine on through all your life. Sacrifice you made for your people, bear fruit. The Great Spirit bless your life. With a heart of love, balance, and patience. Leonard Peltier, free, free at last. Itakuye Oyasin. Blessed by Wakandanga. Wakandanga.
Song for Leonard Peltier. Carlos Nakai. Attorneys for Indigenous activist Leonard Peltier have submitted a formal application for executive clemency to the Office of the Pardon Attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice. An innocent man, Native American activist Leonard Peltier, was wrongly convicted in connection with the shooting deaths of two agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in 1977, has been in prison now for over 40 years. We're joined by attorneys Martin Garbus, who has appeared before the United States Supreme Court as well as trial and appellate courts throughout the United States. He has written numerous briefs that have been submitted to the United States Supreme Court, a number of which have resulted in changes in the law on a nationwide basis. Garbus also participated in drafting several constitutions and foreign laws, and he's been involved in prisoner exchange negotiations between governments and has authored six books. Cynthia Dunn, director of a nonprofit corporation that works with youth on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, worked for 28 years as an assistant United States attorney, where she prosecuted a broad variety of cases, including public corruption and civil rights offenses. Martin Garbus and Cynthia Dunn make the case for clemency for Leonard Peltier, and good morning to both of you.
Hi. Good morning.
Well, Cynthia, I want to begin with you. You wrote for Indian Country Media Network, quote, "When I left my job after 28 years as a federal prosecutor to volunteer on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, I was warned by a friend for the community. Do yourself a favor. Never state an opinion about Leonard Peltier. Well, we both assumed I would oppose Peltier's release from prison. We were wrong." Now, speaking as a legal aid lawyer to a federal prosecutor, former federal prosecutor, your involvement, your interest, your pursuing clemency for Leonard Peltier. Tell us your story on that.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for referencing that, because that's a good point. I wrote that piece that you're referencing to in Indian Country Today in 2015. Before I was hired by Leonard Peltier, before I met Martin Garbus, before I had any idea I would ever have any contact with either, I, working on the reservation, heard about the 1970s all the time from the elders in the community. It's something that still has, or is a source of pain in the community. And they call it the Reign of Terror because of the high crime rate and the seeming apathy from federal law enforcement to enforce the major crimes on the, to bring prosecutions for the major crimes on the reservation. And then this particular incident that occurred in 1975, again, is something that comes up all the time. And the name Leonard Peltier, I had heard it as a prosecutor, but I had, you know, basically accepted wholesale the FBI's presentation that he was a cold-blooded murderer who willingly and deliberately shot two FBI agents at close range in the head mercilessly, and they've got all sorts of adjectives that go with it. And I'd accepted that. And so we both assumed that I was just going to find that if I ever looked into it. But it just kept coming back, and people were so adamant that there was a great injustice there, and working in the community, it was just something that always comes up. So I ultimately decided, well, I'll look into it for myself and see what I can find. And it takes, there's a learning curve involved in this case. People like Martin and others who have lived it for years and knew about this era have their own opinions and basis of knowledge. But as a newcomer to actually considering the case, there is a learning curve to get past what I'm going to call the propaganda about the case. It took me over 100 hours of looking at publicly available records, public press reports, court records, et cetera. And I formed the opinion that this was a really great injustice here, and it ran contrary to everything that I had believed in for my 28 years working in the justice system. I just felt like, wow, how could our government, you know, when we threw it to today's lens, how can we let this stand? And so I wrote that piece. And then, you know, after that, I was contacted by Martin Garbus and ultimately met with Leonard Peltier and agreed to represent him and work with Mr. Garbus on the case. He's the lead counsel. But, you know, the point is that after that, I got access to even additional records, the Freedom of Information Act records that aren't necessarily readily available online, the internal FBI records of the time that show an even, you know, stronger case for this being a great injustice. I think perhaps one of the greatest injustices in the history of the justice system.
Well, that's
so that's how I came to
that's
it.
And a that's heck
why
of
I'm with the team.
That's a heck of an indictment to Martin Garvis. Pick it up from there. I mean, Peltier has been designated a political prisoner by Amnesty International, and people such as Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu had risen to the occasion of support for him. A political prisoner would seem to me to have everything to do with what Cynthia Dunn was just saying. So the case for the injustice that has been perpetrated against Leonard Peltier that has caused you to be his champion these many years.
Well, I think that I was in Nebraska and in South Dakota and in Minneapolis when the Wounded Knee cases were tried. And I represented a number of defendants in Nebraska after the 73 shootout. And I got to understand then Leonard's case. I saw that two other people who were charged with the same crime were ultimately acquitted. I saw the justice system take Leonard's case and move it to a judge who was one of the most, a judge who was most hateful to the Indian community, had total disrespect for them. I saw the justice system shuffle itself so that Leonard could get extradited based on false affidavits from Canada so that he would ultimately stand trial. And then ultimately, when it came to the trial itself, the government acknowledged during the trial, after the trial, that they didn't know who shot the two FBI men. And the ballistics evidence did not support the claim. In fact, it contradicted the claim that Leonard had done the shooting. Well, now Leonard is at this point in his mid-70s, 72. He's been in jail for 42 years. He has spent a good deal of that time in solitary for a crime he did not commit. And one of the most unusual things of this case, and it really sets it apart, I think, from any other American trial, is the appellate judge, the federal appellate judge, asking that Leonard be released because of the government's misconduct during the trial. It's as heinous a case of government misconduct, as you will see. And for that, Leonard Peltier has spent his life in jail. And if he doesn't get out now, if he doesn't get out through Obama, he will most certainly die in jail. It's unlikely that Trump, whether he's there for one or two terms or whoever, is going to release him. If Obama does not, then who will? So we are trying as much as we can. And Cynthia has been running an extraordinary campaign. She's been in Washington. She's met with members of Congress. She's labored endlessly because we all realize that unless it happens by the time Obama leaves, it will not happen. So that's basically the case. It's very funny. In America, the case is known at sub-level. But if you go outside of America, then you find that it's extraordinarily well-known. He's America's leading political prisoner outside of the United States. And there should be an article either today or tomorrow in The Guardian, the British newspaper, about this case, as there already have been articles in much of the media. And there also has been, in addition to this show, other television and radio stations that have been dealing with the case. So it's an enormous issue. If in fact there's any commitment on the part of Obama to reach out to the Native American community, this is that case. At Standing Rock, the demonstrators had placards demanding the release of Leonard Peltier, and they were singing and protesting. So it's an issue from 1975 until now, which is, some 40 years, and the issue stays alive, and this wrongfully convicted man at this point stays in jail.
And Cynthia, I want to go back to what you said, which is really dramatic and remarkable for someone who was a federal prosecutor, and we're talking about the death of two FBI agents, and you're saying this is the most egregious case of misconduct and misjustice that you have ever experienced. Pick up on that and flesh out some of the details of the misconduct that you have seen as the case has progressed over these 40 years that caused you to make that statement.
Okay, it's really, at this point, part of history. Some of the most egregious injustices are really not subject to credible dispute. They've been found so by the courts. The courts have commentated on it, and as Mr. Garbus just mentioned, the appellate judge who reluctantly held the verdict in place, nonetheless said, we need to do something about this and he should be granted clemency. The injustices include, among other things, there were multiple false statements to the press in order to gain a tactical advantage. There were false affidavits submitted to the courts that were just patently false. When you put them next to each other, you can see that they were just created to try to get a result-oriented decision from a court rather than justice. They coerced witness statements, and I guess most telling to me is that they deliberately withheld critical ballistic reports from Mr. Peltier's attorneys during the trial. Among my first look when I was looking through records on my own, I came across a couple of interviews with the prosecutors from the case, and they said, this is such a big case, and there are so many people prosecuting the case, and we lost those records. It wasn't a deliberate withholding of the ballistics reports. That might sound credible in a case like the Bernie Madoff investigation where you've got lots of paper, but I've done murder cases. I've prosecuted murder cases. You don't have a whole lot of paper, and the only person you really look for paper on is going to be your ballistics expert because that's what they're there for, is to testify about their test results, but somehow they lost his test results. And so had him testify contrary to his own test results. But among the records that we have attached to the petition is a FBI memorandum, a teletype, which is how they communicated before the internet, from an FBI agent to his supervisors reporting during trial that the prosecutors had deliberately directed them not to produce ballistics reports to Mr. Peltier's attorneys at trial. So some lying FBI agent out there thought this was such an extraordinary direction that they memorialized it in writing. And what that shows me is there was a real deliberate decision at the time by prosecutors and was gone along with by the FBI agents to give Mr. Peltier a patently unfair trial and to ensure that he was convicted. The prior trial that Mr. Barbas referred to of his co-defendants, Butler and Robidoux, they had debriefed the jurors, and the jurors had told them, among other things, that they would never convict someone in these facts because the place was such a politically charged war zone and the two agents entered private property unannounced. They would never convict someone of shooting, killing them, unless the government could prove that someone was a cold-blooded murderer who had shot these guys deliberately in the head. And so that's what they went out to set to prove in the trial. And that's why they withheld evidence and they changed the theory of the case when it came to Mr. Peltier's trial. They went out to try to hold someone accountable. And Leonard Peltier has been done 40 years in jail and a staggering 5 or 6 years of that time in solitary confinement, which makes it exponentially a much stiffer sentence. And it's really one of the greatest injustices that you'll see when you look at cases. It's mind-boggling to me. Now, we do know that the FBI is actively opposing his release this time around. We received a letter that they oppose his release because the crimes, quote, challenge the rule of law our criminal justice is built on. And, you know, while the rule of law ordinarily is something that is praiseworthy, in this case, it's a shield. It prevents self-reflection. Where was the rule of law when the prosecutors, agents, and their superiors decided to withhold critical exculpatory ballistics proof? Where was the rule of law when they coerced witnesses to provide false testimony? You know, you can't use the rule of law to keep them in jail and not look at your own conduct in that analysis. Here, we're 41 years later. I mean, the time was long ago, but, you know, if not now, as Martin says, he will surely die in jail. He's next eligible for parole in 2024. He's in very poor health. He's in a maximum security prison. You know, the maximum security prisons are not a young man's game. They are a dangerous place for anybody. And, you know, his petition, the clemency petition, asks that the president release him in the interest of justice and reconciliation. And, you know, as I stated before, he is emblematic throughout Indian country of this history of injustices. And there are very few things that a sitting president can do that is actually an act, that is an act, not just talk about reconciliation. And this is one of them. The NCAI and former UN rapporteur on indigenous rights, they all wrote supporting letters saying this would resound throughout Indian country. This would help restore faith in the law enforcement system, in the communities around the country. It's a big case. It lives on because it has never been faced. It has never been reckoned with, really.
And, you know, Martin Garbus, I remember when the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals acknowledged back in the early 2000s that much of the government's behavior at the Pine Ridge Reservation and its prosecution of Leonard Peltier was to be condemned. Why hasn't that kind of statement taken us further? Leonard has long been due a new trial and is long overdue for a parole. His application for clemency was denied, his last one in 2009. Place Leonard's case in the context of the incredible bad behavior, the bias, the backwardness of the government's response to the indigenous people in Pine Ridge.
Well, I lived in Pine Ridge for 4 months back then. One of the things that we have really forgotten is Wounded Knee demonstrations. When they occur, Richard Nixon, through General Haig, orders the military to attack the demonstrators. And at that point in time, it was astonishing that military personnel, called a Posse Comitatus, was organized to attack American citizens. It was the first time that it happened in that century. Now, your question is, why has this not been dealt with? It's not been dealt with in large part because Native Americans are not seen as having political power, are not a respected community. Cynthia has been spending an extraordinary amount of time attempting to deal with Congress people, to get Congress people to petition to ask President Obama to release Linda Peltier. She spent some time in Washington last week. Altogether, 55 members of Congress over a period of time have asked that Leonard Peltier be released. But he hasn't been. So that's the course of American justice. I represented recently Gerardo Hernandez, a Cuban who had two life sentences plus 15 years. It took a negotiation between another head of state and Obama to get him released. Leonard Peltier doesn't have that kind of clout. He doesn't have large, powerful people speaking on his behalf relentlessly. Yes, he has members of the Congress. He has the liberal community. He has, as Cynthia mentioned, Nelson Mandela, Bishop Tutu, and hosts of others, Ramsey. We've seen at Standing Rock where that community did have some power and was able to achieve some results, certainly with the help of President Obama. Whether or not there's enough power now to persuade the president to release Leonard Peltier is something that we'll see in the years ahead. But Cynthia it's unusual for a former prosecutor who prosecuted cases for 28 years to come in and say, as Cynthia has done, this is my professional life. This is who I prosecuted. And here's a case that is so startling that I, for the first time in my professional life, are coming out and condemning government action. So the fact that Cynthia is doing it is a very new and powerful voice on his behalf. And maybe her voice and the effort she has made will result in Leonard being released.
And with that, Cynthia Dunn, you made the case before members of Congress. Make the case for us now and tell our listeners what to do to immediately support clemency for Leonard Peltier.
Well, first and foremost, they should write to their elected officials and ask them to notify the president and the U.S. pardon attorney that they support clemency for Leonard Peltier. That, you know, enough is enough. After 41 years, you know, justice has been served under any interpretation of the case. And it's time to allow him to go home for his final years of life and to live his final years of life at Turtle Mountain Reservation. So they can write to their elected officials. They can do it by email or on their websites. The most impactful at this point, probably because we're so short, we've got such a short fuse here, because January 20th is the last day. If he's the clemency petition is not authorized by then he will likely die in jail. So they could write to the president easily through Amnesty International's website. They have it as an action page, and when you click on it, you have the option to sign their petition, which I would urge everybody to do. It takes about 2 minutes. Or you can send a letter to your elected official. It's all completely set up for you. If you want to amend the letter slightly, you can. But you can use that as a tool. It's very easy. It's Amnesty International. It's their website, and it's on their front page as an action. And when you click on that, you get your choice for the petition and to write a letter. This is probably the most impactful way at this time that people can take action. You know, this would be a great injustice. I mean, right now, Leonard Peltier is an icon throughout Indian country and really around the world. When the UN did its report on indigenous people in 2012, they included this as one of the open wounds that is hurting Indian country today. So let's see if we can, you know, get this over the finish line. Right now, it's at the Department of Attorney's office, we believe. It has to be handed over to the president before he can act on it. He can't act on it until it gets presented. So let's let everybody, you know, get going. It takes 2 minutes. Support what's right. We all should, this shouldn't be politicized. You know, as Martin said, the liberal community supports it. Everybody should be supporting this. If you believe that the justice system stands for equality and equal rights for everyone, and that the protections that we have apply to people who are innocent or guilty, if you believe in those things, then you should support allowing Leonard Peltier to live his final years in the interest of reconciliation and in the interest of justice.
Now, I also want to say that people can call the White House. The number is 202-456-1111. That number again is 202-456-1111. And you can ask Barack Obama to grant Leonard Peltier clemency. All these calls are logged in and they are available to the president. So you can go to the Amnesty International website, sign the petition. I know that there are over 55,000 people that have done so to date.
Over 101,000 actually this week.
Oh, better. Fabulous. Yeah. So let's get that up to several hundred thousand, which I know with our listeners' support we can do. And I really want to thank both of you. And we're going to do another piece on this before the deadline. But Martin Garvis, the last plea here for our listeners as to why they should get on board for clemency for Leonard Peltier.
There has to be ultimately some sense of decency in the American legal system. We have to go back to the ideas of law and justice. We have to reaffirm what the country is about and what we believe is proper. And the jailing of Leonard Peltier for over 40 years, 6 years in solitary, at amongst other places, Lompoc Prison, one of the most horrendous places in the United States, is awful. And this is the time to deal with it.
And actually, I said the last word to Martin, but I'm going to go back and give another last word to Cynthia Dunn. And I'm just interested, as somebody who's spending a great deal of time on the Pine Ridge Reservation, the additional passion of the people there that is behind the clemency. Just tell us about that and how important to Indigenous people's rights, sovereignty, self-determination is freedom for Leonard Peltier.
Right. I mean, I'm an outsider in the community. I can report what I've been told, but I can't necessarily speak for them. But I have spoken with several survivors of that era. And one, when she learned that I was involved in the representation of Leonard Peltier, just burst out in tears and said she'd never thought that she would see, you know, someone she knows actually standing up for this. And she had lived through the 70s. So it's just, you know, it hurts and the pain is still there. And I can tell you that the feeling of that Native Americans are not being treated as equal value in today's society is still there. It's there on the Pine Ridge Reservation. It's there in the border towns. I spend a lot of time in Rapid City. I've actually counseled some entities and civic groups on how to try to help address some of the really blatant discrimination that still exists in the region. You know, this would go a long way for so many different reasons, not only to restore faith in the justice system, but to show that we as Americans are prepared to turn a page and we're willing to look back and we're willing to listen to all of those watchdogs and humanitarians that have stood by him for 40 years, because, you know, it's right. It's the right thing to do. So, yeah, I urge everybody to call the White House, get on Amnesty's website, www.amnestyusa.org. It's right there on the front page. You click it, in 2 minutes, you've got a petition signed, and you've got a letter to the president. And, you know, you'll be doing something good today that will be on the right side, and you'll be standing on the right side of history. Because I really do believe this will be recorded by historians as one of the greatest injustices in the history of the American justice system.
And interestingly enough, Judge Gerald Heaney of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, who sat as a member of the court in two of Peltier's appeals, actually talks about Leonard Peltier as a political prisoner and supports the movement for clemency for this man who has on six occasions been nominated for a Nobel Prize. And I also must mention that Peltier is an accomplished author and I think one of the finest graphic artists of my lifetime. Just a magnificent, heroic individual who has suffered mercilessly. The courts have, in my understanding and research, been had federal prosecutors who have admitted that the government can't prove who shot the agents. The FBI used improper tactics in securing Peltier's extradition initially from Canada and otherwise investigating the case. There is a body of information. We will continue to pursue this right up to the deadline. The case for clemency for Leonard Peltier. Get on board. Sign that Amnesty International petition or call the White House. Write to your elected official. Special thanks for the work that they are doing for Leonard Peltier of the two exceptional, socially conscious attorneys, Martin Garvis.
You know, Mimi, we want to thank you, Cynthia and I, for the program,
Absolutely. For
the things you've said, and giving us a chance to reach people who have been told what they can do. It's very rare that people really within this country can do something by themselves that will have a political and human effect. This is one of those rare cases. Your votes can get lost in elections. There can be confusion. But here you have an opportunity to help save a man's life and make a statement for one of the most important causes and on behalf of one of the most beleaguered minorities in the country. So thank you, Mimi, for what you've done.
Well, thank you all. We are in this together in the cause for justice and the cause for clemency for Leonard Peltier. We've been speaking with Martin Garvis and Cynthia Dunn. We're going to have him back again because we got to press the case. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Light will shine on through all your life. Sacrifice you made for your people. Bear fruit. The Great Spirit bless your life. With a heart of love, balance, and patience. Leonard Peltier, free, free at last. Mitakuye Oyasi. Blessed by Wakandanga.
Exploitation. give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue. They couldn't believe it when I said yes. And then I said, you ain't heard nothing yet. We are based in Washington, D.C., a truly diverse community. Almost 600,000 strong have been exploited much too long.
Well, that's Sweet Honey and the Rock, who are talking about representation in the district of this nation, Washington, D.C., and we are turning our attention to voting rights, in effect. And Rob Ritchie is the executive director of Fair Vote, a non-for-profit organization that researches and advocates election reforms that increase voter turnout, accountable governance, and fair representation. And with that, I want to start with the issue of the Electoral College. It just voted to make Donald Trump president. So Rob Ritchie, described the political motivation purpose for the Electoral College from its inception and precisely its authority and how it just legitimized the election of Donald Trump. And then we'll get into the meat of our discussion on really what is a fair vote. And thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Mimi. Well, it's obviously on a lot of people's minds this week and this year. But the Electoral College has been with us since the beginning of the Constitution, and it is a artifact of the reality that when we had those constitutional founders come together, they did not have any consensus about the basic right to vote. Right, so there was no belief that everyone should have a right to vote, and in fact, the great majority of people could not vote. The country was extremely different at that time. I think there was, 95% of Americans lived in towns smaller than 5,000 people. Right, it was just like a very different kind of country, and not that many people voted. But some states, more people voted than others, and then many states had slavery, of course, where people had no remote chance of voting. There was a whole debate about how to allocate political power based on numbers of people. The idea that if you have more people, you should have more members of the House. And so that's where the infamous or three-fifths compromise came up for how to count slaves. And then when you get to the question of choosing the president, at that time, most governors actually weren't elected. They were chosen by their state legislature, kind of like a parliamentary system. So that was sort of one idea, that Congress could pick the president. There was some people, some brave souls from Pennsylvania that wanted a popular vote for president, but, they had these very different suffrage rules in different states, and that didn't go far at all. And so the idea of the Electoral College essentially was to say, well, let's kind of maintain the structure of political power based on the numbers of people that we set up for the House, punt the decision down to the states, and let states figure out how to construct the Electoral College. And so that was the compromise, which so each state would have a number of electors equal to their number of members of Congress, and that state would come up with its own rules to pick how those electors would be chosen. So the interesting byproduct, and they first actually had two votes, and they would go and cast for two different people, and whoever got the most votes would become president, and whoever finished second would become vice president. And they sort of had a concept that, there wouldn't be political parties, and the vice president might be Hillary Clinton serving next to Donald Trump or something like that. And but that very quickly didn't work as something that people wanted to do, and there was some strange elections, the 1800 election. So they actually changed the Constitution super quickly to limit it to one vote per elector. But the bottom reality is that states have had this power over the years. They moved gradually to always having a popular vote within the state, but actually we didn't have our first national choice for president where everyone had a vote, or everyone who at least had voting rights could vote for president until after the Civil War. That for all those preceding elections, one or more states had their state legislature pick the electors. So we sort of cycle up to today, And every state is having a vote for president with the voting rules they have in that state. And almost every state gives all of their electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote in that state. Though a couple do it by congressional district, and that's a little window into the fact that they can do different things than giving the popular vote, than giving all their electors to the popular vote winner. But anyway, there's some pretty perverse consequences of the current rules, and a lot of people are observing those today.
Well, aside from things like voter, and I shouldn't say aside from, but, you know, we have voter suppression efforts to disenfranchise primarily the African-American vote. We have a historically low turnout. We have statewide recounts with, minimal shifts and no federal standards for presidential recounts. The absence of, public funding of campaigns and the influence of dark money and private fortunes financing campaigns, gerrymandering. What do you think needs to be done to really reform the electoral system to make it a much more representative body? And I know part of the answer of that is ranked choice voting. I want you to talk about that and explain it, since for some of us who are a bit mathematically challenged, sometimes we have a hard time understanding the concept.
Sure. So That history wasn't too long-winded, but just sort of that history shows that there's a progression that's always been taking place, which is we started in a very different place than we are today. You know, so the country was extremely different. The degree of democracy was very different, and who could vote? Many more people can vote today. What's interesting about the United States' way of change is it's always been sort of driven, on almost every instance, from the city and state upward. So you can get better in states than other states. And so women could get the right to vote in some states before others. And eventually we got to this threshold point where talking about a constitutional amendment was possible. The idea of direct election of U.S. senators, they were not elected by the popular vote till just barely 100 years ago. That also started in the states, and states started to figure out mechanisms to have popular vote elections for the Senate. And so there is, I'll just say, on the Electoral College, go to nationalpopularvote.com. That's an advocacy organization that we work with to reform the Electoral College. And it's a state-based movement that New York State has passed, my state of Maryland has passed, a number of other states have passed, which once a sufficient number of states pass it, would actually effectuate a national popular vote for president. And that can be done via the states. We also could change the Constitution, but you can drive things forward. Another great state-based change happened in Maine this year, which is ranked choice voting, or some people like to use the name instant runoff voting, which is the same system. And it's one that when you're in this basic reality, which we very often are, of having more than two electoral choices, so in a November election, you've got a third party running in addition to the major parties, or if a bunch of people are running in a primary, your vote gets more power, gets more voice, because you're not limited to just vote for one person. You can say, here's my first choice. However, I'm going to indicate my second choice and my third choice, and as many choices as I want to, until I don't care about the candidates. And when you do that, you're directing your ballot to really sort of think for you during the count, because what they do is you add up all the first choices, and those are the results that we ordinarily see today. So this year in the presidential result, there were 14 states where no one won half the votes, including pretty much all the swing states. And in those swing states, Gary Johnson and Jill Stein were running, and some more minor candidates, and anyone who voted for them was, you know, making their statement for those candidates, but not being able to indicate whether they cared about Trump versus Clinton. And with a ranked choice system, they could say, okay, my first choice is Jill Stein, or my first choice is Gary Johnson. However, my second choice is so-and-so. And then if that candidate, if no one wins a majority, so if you get a majority, then you're done. If you don't get a majority, then the trailing candidates are dropped from the race, and their ballots are examined and allocated to whoever's ranked second. And so if I voted for Gary Johnson and listed Donald Trump second, my ballot would go to him. If I voted for Jill Stein and listed Hillary Clinton second, my ballot would count to Clinton. And then you would get like a pair-to-pair, you know, a head-to-head comparison. And so what it does is allow, and that's passed in Maine. It passed, the voters approved it this year. They're going to use it for U.S. Senate, U.S. House, governor, state legislature starting in 2018. It's a state where it really is going to make a difference because they have a long history of third party and independence going well, but it would really allow our politics to breathe. And all the voter has to do at the end of the day is rank candidates first, second, and third. There's actually been a fun debate about it right there in New York City. There's a bill in the city council with majority support to use this for the citywide primary runoff, or to get rid of that runoff and just go to an instant runoff. So that's something that, that listeners could actually, urge their counselors to just push to the finish line. And it's something that really makes sense across the country.
Why do you think that ranked choice voting would help create a richer, a more civil, and a more robust dialogue on the issues? Continue to flesh that out for me.
Yeah, well, I guess here's a couple of ways to think about it. I think right now, in these high-profile presidential races, say, we do get third parties running. It's not unusual to have major party, to have the candidate not win half the votes. And this year, that not only did Donald Trump lose the popular vote by, you know, almost 3 million votes, but Clinton didn't win a majority of the popular vote either, and there was all those results in states. And so the third party candidates are in this difficult position for sort of for everyone, because they have to make a case that vote for me, it doesn't really matter about those candidates that have a better chance to win. And they have to sort of take a stance that for a lot of people sort of intellectually off-putting. But on the other hand, this argument like, well, you shouldn't even run, you know, just take your medicine and just settle, you know, and not have your voice heard for what you think the country should do, that's a very disappointing and frustrating position for others, for many as well. And so this is like, okay, you can actually, you know, do both. And all it takes is being able to indicate your backup choices. It's not that hard to do. And in fact, this is done, by the way, you know, a dozen cities, some big cities, Minneapolis, San Francisco, Portland, Maine. And one key reason why it won in Maine is they use it in Portland, which is their biggest city, and it got 71% there because people like it, and it's used in many countries overseas. Your voice is more heard, and you get a more representative outcome because you really get this one-on-one choice. You can think about it at the local level. Just one quick example for me was the 2013 mayoral race that de Blasio won in the primary. Was a multi-candidate race, you have a runoff, but no candidate gets at least 40%. He ended up getting just over 40%. So he didn't even get 50, by the way. But he didn't have to do a runoff. With an instant runoff, the candidates would have treated each other's voters differently and been better candidates, I think, and ultimately maybe better mayors because they had to just sort of run differently. And so one example was John Liu, a Chinese American, was running for mayor. Everyone knew he was not going to win. He was a citywide official, but he had some problems that made it unlikely for him to win. But people in Chinatown still liked him, and he ended up getting like 70-80% of the vote, I think, out of Chinatown. And he got like 7 or 8%. And so what happened was the other candidates just kind of didn't do much in Chinatown. They sort of ignored a whole segment of the primary electorate because they knew they were sort of not going to win those votes. With an instant runoff ranked choice system, they would have known all of those votes were in play and that they would need to position themselves to be second choices for those voters. And that would have been good. It would have meant that they would have had to talk to more voters and learn what makes them tick. And that also means that in that sense of negative campaigning, if you sort of go back to like the Clinton-Stein thing where there's got to be a lot of bitterness really between those camps, or Nader Gore, or, you know, we can have many examples over the years. It would be different if the Clinton camp actually knew they needed those Stein voters, and they needed to position themselves to be second. And Stein could have run a campaign where she could have said, hey, I really think what I'm saying is better. This is better for the country. This is what we need to have my views become what the president does. But not have to indicate, but it doesn't really matter about the major choice, which I think was a position that was a difficult one to sell. There would have been a different tenor to that relationship. But I think at the end of the day, it just gives the voters more voice and more power, and that's a good thing.
So for fair vote, as we wind up this segment and look at our prospects for democratizing the vote, which is clearly needed, what are the major campaigns on the horizon for fair vote that we can jump on board and realize before we are at the precipice, as we have been this time, although, as you mentioned, Maine successfully heralded in ranked choice voting. So the major campaigns we can jump on board with.
There are things. I mean, here's the thing. The whole history of this country of changing our electoral process and democratizing it, which is, of course, not done. There's a heck of a lot to do, and there's a regression going on out there. The laws restricting access, you know, we got to fight against those. But the progress has always come from what we can do in cities and states. And ultimately that gets up to Congress. And so there's a lot we can do. And as Maine shows, you can change in your state how you vote for Congress, right? So that's a big deal. Like, you know, they're going to use ranked choice voting for Senate and House, right? They can do it for president, by the way. That's just a statutory matter as well. So there's a lot that one can do at that level, kind of engaging with local and state officials about making things better. The big campaigns among many, and we're not the only groups doing great work out there, but the ones that we're particularly focused on are this national popular vote for president, which New York has already passed, but there's sort of energy to keep pushing that forward and sort of talk about it and realize, you know, New York Times just yesterday, very strong editorial, you know, making the case for it. Then the ranked choice voting can be done, and I would love to see it starting in the city. In those citywide primary races, it's sort of a slam dunk argument to do it, and actually a majority support in the city council and has passed the state senate this year. So it's something that needs to keep pushing forward, and the mayor needs to hear from people that he should let it happen, because it seems to be that he's blocking it. And then bold and biggest idea, and I don't have much time to explain it, but I'll just say
we have 1 minute.
we do not have to accept gerrymandered, lopsided, one-party districts which dominate Congress and our state legislative elections, where you don't have a two-party choice, let alone a multi-party choice. So there's going to be a bill in Congress. So if people go to the URL fairrepresentation.com. It'll go to an approach that can be done by statute that would just open up congressional elections to American forms of proportional representation. And we have a couple members of Congress that want to get that debate going and more ready to support it. And ultimately, if we want the Congress to be as representative as we want the presidential election to be, that's going to be key. And it's an exciting change that can be done by statute. And, you know, people could have real elections everywhere and much fairer representation. And that's sort of the biggest, boldest idea.
Well, we're going to pursue it. Make sure that you go to Fair Vote. All of this is on their very intuitive and accessible website. Rob Ritchie from Fair Vote, thank you for the work you've done these many years on really democratizing the voting process and making our respective votes count more, and to really move to the not the dilution of our vote, but the re-involvement of people in the voting process. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and for all the work, thank you.
Thank you, Mimi. Really appreciate it.
Well, you are certainly listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Where else would you hear the full case for clemency for Leonard Peltier? I'm Mimi Rosenberg with the Wednesday edition of The Morning Shows. Coming up, can Amway billionaire Betsy DeVos, Donald Trump's nominee for the position of Secretary of Education, change the landscape of public education in favor of Kentucky Fried Children turned out of a privatized and commercialized market-driven system? Then the Black is Back Coalition says it won't allow MLK's birthday to be used as a celebration for the inauguration of Trump, and issues a call for African people to unite and converge on Washington towards a black agenda for self-determination. Then after 32 years in prison, the calls grow for President Obama to release Puerto Rican activist Oscar Lopez Rivera. All that and more, but first, Public News Service morning news headlines.
Welcome to the Public News Service daily newscast for Wednesday, December 21st, 2016. I'm Mary Sherman. Today's rundown covers a variety of topics, including heightened security in the states after deadly attacks overseas, parts of the Atlantic and Alaska now off limits to oil drilling, and children's groups warn of dire consequences of a quick Obamacare repeal. Our top story, cities across the U.S. are heightening security after a deadly series of incidents abroad. Additional police officers are being deployed in New York and Chicago, with emphasis on crowded public areas and holiday gatherings. Both cities caution that the increased presence of law enforcement was a preventive measure and that no specific threats were received. Monday night, 11 people were killed in Berlin after a truck plowed through a Christmas market. Earlier in the day, the Russian ambassador to Turkey was assassinated, and three people were wounded after a gunman opened fire at an Islamic center in Switzerland. Nearly 30 people were killed and dozens injured after an explosion ripped through a popular fireworks market in Mexico. The market is said to be especially busy during the Christmas season. Two previous explosions, which also destroyed the market, happened leading up to Independence Day celebrations. President Barack Obama will use his executive authority to permanently block offshore drilling in large swaths of the Arctic and Atlantic oceans. Likewise, neighboring Canada will halt oil and gas exploration in its own Arctic waters, according to a joint statement from Obama and Canada's prime minister. A White House spokesman said the president's action recognizes the unique ecological value in these areas. The withdrawal includes 115 million acres in the Arctic and 3.8 million acres in the North and Mid-Atlantic Ocean. All they want for Christmas is to keep their families together. That's the message dozens of Florida kids hope to send to their elected leaders today as they plead for an end to deportations. The story from Mona Shand.
In Miami, 17-year-old Elena Marquez says she hasn't seen her father in person in 4 years, since he was deported after being pulled over for driving with an expired license. Marquez says she's speaking out because she can't stand the thought of other families being torn apart that way.
It's not just about myself, but it's also about the other people who have been in the same situation as I have, or maybe even worse, because I may not know their story, but I know that we all suffer the same.
Instead of writing lists for presents or holiday cards, Marquez and close to 100 other children of undocumented immigrants from the Miami area have written letters to Mayor Carlos Jimenez, calling on him to protect their families as their only holiday wish. Those letters are being delivered to his office today.
A former spokesman to Hillary Clinton's campaign blasted the FBI Tuesday after the public release of a warrant used during the agency's investigation into Clinton's use of a private email server while Secretary of State. Clinton campaign spokesman Brian Fallon says the document showed that the FBI's intrusion on the election was utterly unjustified. The warrant shows that investigators believe there was probable cause that a laptop seized as part of an investigation contained classified information pertinent to its then-closed probe into Clinton's server, but the document provided few specifics. The risk of child abuse and neglect could rise if Congress repeals the Affordable Care Act without immediately replacing it. That's the warning today by a coalition of children's advocates in Arizona.
The groups point to a recent statement by Governor Doug Ducey that a rushed repeal would mean massive cuts to Medicaid, with up to 600,000 Arizonans losing coverage. Becky Ruffner with the group Prevent Child Abuse Arizona says it would be a huge setback for families caught up in the foster care system.
Without our Medicaid expansion, those parents would not be eligible for any kind of substance abuse treatment, mental health counseling to get back on track and get their children back. So children would be left in foster care for longer periods.
Arizona cares for 17,000 foster children at any given time. President-elect Trump, concerned about premium hikes and the individual insurance mandate, has vowed to repeal the ACA right away, but hasn't proposed a specific plan to replace it. At the Capitol today, groups are pressing Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake to insist on a replacement before any repeal. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Charges were announced Tuesday against two former state of Michigan emergency managers with multiple 20-year felonies for their failure to protect the citizens of Flint from health hazards caused by contaminated drinking water. Two former Flint workers also face felony charges of false pretenses and conspiracy to to commit false pretenses. Before Tuesday, 9 people, including 8 low- and mid-level state workers and an employee of Flint's water plant, had been charged in the water crisis, which has been linked to the lead poisoning of Flint children and the deaths of 12 people from Legionnaire's disease. A company that started as a class project for 2 college students has expanded into a community service effort for more than 12,000 students at nearly 800 college campuses across the country. We get more from Veronica Carter.
Zachary Quinn and Brian Keller were students at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul when they launched Love Your Melon. The idea was to provide beanies and baseball caps for local children with cancer, but it was so successful they started a company with half of the profits going to pediatric cancer research. Spokesman Alex Meisman says college students go to hospitals dressed up in superhero costumes to deliver the caps to the kids.
And then they get to bring them in and, you know, go room to room, do arts and crafts with the kids. I mean, this can go from having a little music show or some kind of play all the way up to having a celebrity come in and perform for these kids.
In the last 4 years, Love Your Melon has provided more than 86,000 hats to children with cancer and raised more than $1.5 million for cancer research. The beanies are made by Minnesota Knitting Mills, and the baseball caps are made in Denver.
I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service. Member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
And now we turn our attention to education. Carol Burris, principal of Southside High School in Rockville Center for 15 years and an outspoken critic of Common Core standards and related testing, left that post to fight what she says are harmful educational reforms. Carol Burris has become executive director of the Network for Public Education Foundation, assuming that position after serving as the principal of Southside High School since 2000. Dr. Burris has co-authored Detracking for Excellence and Equity and Opening the Common Core, How to Bring All Students to College and Career Readiness, and authored On the Same Track, How Schools Can Join the 21st Century Struggle Against Resegregation. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Mimi?
Well, we're good within the scheme of things. Carol Burris, how do you see Trump's pick for Secretary of Education, Amway billionaire Betsy DeVos, seeking to transform the educational landscape of the United States in her position at the head of a department that has a role in overseeing the schooling of more than 50 million American children?
Well, in one word, train wreck. There are, I think, 4 compelling reasons why she should not lead the department. The first is she believes in unregulated schooling. Her allegiance is to the marketplace. It's not to children. And we know that because just this summer she spent well over $1 million in contributions to policymakers in order to try to limit regulations that would rein in some of the abuses in Michigan charter schools. Second is she supports the privatization of schooling, and she really is determined to destroy our democratically governed public school system. Her passion is for 2 things: the expansion of charter schools, especially for-profit charter schools, and vouchers to private and religious schools. She's also a big supporter of virtual schools, which are an absolute disaster. I mean, even charter school organizations have concerns about those. Third is, and this is one of the ones that worry me the most, is that her influence and her lobbying practices are ethically suspect. She proudly touts that her family is the biggest contributor of soft money to the Republican National Committee. And a quote from Betsy is, "We've decided to stop taking offense at the suggestion that we are buying influence. Now I simply concede the point. We do expect something in return." I mean, that's chilling. Everybody knows it. But to have the audacity to say it is something else. And right now, she had illegally contributed to campaign funds in Ohio through her school choice PAC, resulting in a fine of over $5 million. And she has yet to repay that, or her family funds have yet to repay that. And fourth is, you know, DeVos is unqualified. She never attended a public school. Her children never attended a public school. She's not an educator. She has no background in education. She is someone with strong right-wing opinions who believes that this is part of bringing the kingdom of God to America through her vision of reform of public schools. I mean, I just don't know how it could get worse.
Well, you know, if you can talk for a moment about there's the Children First America, and then there's the American Education Reform Council and the American Federation for Children. Now, Betsy DeVos is not just an advocate. She's really virtually a zealot on privatizing education, whether it's through the parochial school process or the charter school process. Can you talk a little bit about these institutions that she's, or these organizations that she advocates for, her positioning there? And then let's get into the meat of the debate about privatizing education, which seems to be the Kentucky Fried Children model seems to be most on the horizon.
Yeah. I mean, all of these organizations, and you know, I see it all the time, especially in the charter world, is they have very benevolent names, and some of them are 501c3s. For them. They're allowed to do a certain amount of lobbying on the taxpayer dime, essentially, when you get a deduction, right? And then what you usually find is there's also a linked 501c4, and those are able to do things like endorse candidates. Then you'll have PACs that are spinoffs. And it's always a very tangled web trying to figure out who's behind, who's giving money. But this is, you know, the tools that her family uses in order to influence policy. And they've done it time and time again in this state of Michigan. I think I mentioned that they spent well over $1 million to limit the proposed regulations. But they also spent in Michigan $5.6 million in order to try to expand vouchers. Now, even in Michigan, that didn't fly. And that was a great disappointment to them, but that doesn't stop the DeVos family. And you have to think of Betsy also as part of a bigger network that includes her husband, Dick, who back in 2002, Dick DeVos was calling public schools government schools, right? So there was a very determined campaign through messaging to turn our nation against our neighborhood public schools that are governed by elected school boards. I mean, that's the government of public schools, right? Except for those cases where mayors have grabbed power in cities, but still there's an elected official behind it. The DeVos family doesn't want this, and when you look at the philosophy of what they support with those different groups that you mentioned, you see a pattern that believes that the market is the only way to provide good schooling, and that the way to deal with quality is to have parents and kids choose with their feet, right? And so when we have massive school closures, for example, with a lot of these charters, very, very abrupt, or we have outright cases of fraud, or we have terrible models like cyber charters, you know, where kids who don't want to get up in the morning, their parents give in and send them to a cyber school. I mean, all of these things without regulation will mean that we're going to wake up in 10 years or in 20 years and have an electorate and a citizenry that is truly, truly undereducated. And it's, for me, it's very frightening.
Carol Burris, Trump campaigned on a platform proposing to assign $20 billion of federal funds to a block grant aimed at opening up school choice. The assumption is that the productive competition between schools will result. As he said, competition always does it. Trump said that if we were speaking about air-conditioned factories rather than, you know, academic institutions, the weak fall out and the strong get better. The problem, as you see it, with the particularly the voucher system, the privatization of education, because there are certainly people who are discouraged with the production and progress of the public school arena for their children. How do you respond to these issues?
Well, look, I mean, change can result in three outcomes, right? Things can get better, things can stay the same, or they can get worse. So privatization is going to make things worse, not better. And the evidence is there. You just mentioned vouchers a few moments ago. You know, there's no evidence. There's no good evidence, right? There are some think tanks that are designed to produce, you know, the results that they want. But when you look at the objective literature, there's nothing that lets us know that vouchers work. Students using vouchers were found to underperform traditional public school students in multiple states, including the state of Ohio. And that was a study by the Fordham Institute in 2016. The Fordham Institute is actually a very conservative education think tank. Even in New Orleans, right, what everybody thinks of as the hotbed of school choice, a study by the Education Research Alliance found that voucher student test scores have slipped below traditional public school counterparts between 8 to 16 percentile points. We know in the state of Indiana, for example, where Mike Pence expanded vouchers, not only is it not having a positive effect, what it's doing is it's causing a real problem in terms of loss of tax dollars. So you haven't, you know, the education sector, it can't seem to be able to budget enough money. It's always running in the red. Because what happens is people who would use vouchers, who would send their kids to private school anyway, are now grabbing tax dollars for vouchers. And part of the problem too, Mimi, is that the voucher systems that are out there give parents between $4,000 and $6,000. That's the average. Well, you can't get into a really good private school if you don't have the rest of the money, right? So two things happen. Either the people who would use, who would be sending their kids anyway use the vouchers, or what happens is substandard private schools that are like the worst of the charters open up, and that's where parents wind up going. And, there's no evidence that any of this works. Chile tried it. They created this horrible four-tier system based on the privatization ideas that have come, you know, for the last 30 years down the pike with the Friedman Foundation. Mm-hmm. And what they had was this horrible system, very stratified in terms of SES, where you have municipal schools on the bottom, which is what is left of the public schools. And that's where basically the poor send their children, kids with learning disabilities, people who are disenfranchised. Then you have the charter schools, right? Then you have the voucher schools, and then finally the elite private schools, which are like Exeter and some of the elite private schools in this country. And now they're trying to unwind it. There's unrest in the streets. There are demonstrations. People want a good public school system back. But, you know, once you break that egg, it's really, really hard to put it back. Sweden's experiment with privatization has not worked well. Their PISA scores continue to drop. You look next door to Finland, which invested in an excellent public school system, put money in, made it more equitable for all kids, and you see the scores go up. So, you know, there's no evidence that any of this works. It's based on a belief and almost a hatred of our public school system, where children of all races and all economic backgrounds sit side by side. And I mean, there are limitations to that because we have such segregated neighborhoods. But instead of working on those pieces, we're starting to work on these false solutions that are not benefiting kids. I mean, we're just not seeing any evidence of it. Privatization's not going to start with Betsy DeVos. Mm. Privatization's been underway now for quite a while.
Well, you know, one of the other things that DeVos had been talking about was that the applying the logic of the marketplace to schoolyard precincts, she has repeatedly questioned the values of those very precincts, of the physical existence. She has remarked that in the internet age, the tendency to equate education with specific school buildings is going to be greatly diminished. That I find tremendously alarming. I have always seen, in its best instance, a school building within a specific precinct as a kind of heart and soul for the development. Or it certainly should be for the community, for the parents, for the learning experience. This is something that she really ideologically questions, which, as I said, I find quite alarming.
It is quite alarming. And, you know, when she's talking about that, too, she's not only talking about kids going willy-nilly on buses or trains or in their parents' cars to get to schools well outside their neighborhood. She's also talking about cyber schooling. And online schooling is a disaster. You know, I'm not a technophobe. I think technology has a place in education. But, you know, I came back recently from a trip to California where you see what they call these independent learning centers, right? There are schools in shopping malls, literally in shopping malls, that kids only need to attend 2 hours a week. The rest of their work is either packet work or it is work that they do online, right? Now, listen, if you're maybe a kid or a young adult who dropped out of school and now you're trying to get a diploma, something like that might make sense, but they're letting kids as young as seventh grade in these schools. As young as seventh grade.
Yeah.
You know, how do you know whether a child is being abused? How do you know whether a child is in that school because they're depressed? How do you develop a child socially and emotionally? These are all important functions of schooling you can't have in this cyber world. And their results are horrific. If you look at the graduation rates of cyber charters nationwide, it's 40%. 40%. And, you know, you have some much lower. I found some of these schools in California with 0% four-year graduation rates. You know, and what happens is you see tremendous scandals being associated with them. You have for-profit companies like K-12 in Virginia that become the charters become fronts, right? So somebody will open up a little nonprofit organization in California, and then they buy all of their services, the curriculum, the teachers, everything from K-12. K-12 recently had to give millions of dollars back to the state of California because it was cooking the books on attendance, right? They were pretending kids were going and when they weren't going. It was a huge scandal in Pennsylvania with a cyber charter where this guy was making millions upon millions of dollars and buying houses and a jet. His name was Trombetta. They got him on tax evasion. He's going to be going to jail. You know, the cyber charters in the state of Pennsylvania get the same amount of money as brick-and-mortar charters. So that, for example, in the Bethlehem School District, for every kid that attends a cyber charter, the district has to pay $11,000 for each kid. Now, you know, in a cyber school, it's not costing them $11,000 a kid to educate the child. And this then drains all of the resources from districts. And then what they get is they get the kid back maybe in a couple of years, undereducated, or the kid just slips through the cracks and never becomes a graduate at all. And, you know, for her to say this is great shows one or two things. Either that she doesn't care at all about America's children, or she is woefully ignorant about what is going on. And I think both of those choices are, they're just unacceptable for someone to lead, you know, our nation's schools.
Well, Carol Burris, we've just skimmed the surface and must continue this discourse. I mean, to me, the idea of people like DeVos, whose lodestar really has been her conviction that any non-traditional public education, public school is better than a traditional one simply because it's not operated by the government, can't hold water and shouldn't. So we're going to continue to explore these very controversial issues, and I thank you for your extraordinary contributions and work. And as I said, you know, the idea that somebody left their work as after decades because of her vocation to public education and to our children is the kind of guest that we need to have on. And Carol Burris, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you. And if I could just ask listeners, the Network for Public Education, and you can do that with, that's our website, www.networkforpubliceducation.org, has a toolkit to help oppose Betsy DeVos. And we give letters, sample letters. We give scripts for calling, how to get in touch with your senators, how to write a letter to the editor, give you samples, everything you need. We need everybody in this fight. No more sitting back. No more saying, let somebody else do it. Every person who is listening, who loves public education and believes it is the pillar of our democracy, needs to act, and they need to act fast.
Take it seriously. Let's be proactive instead of winding up being on the defensive and reactive. Let's oppose Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary. Thank you again, Carol Burris.
Thank you, Mimi. Bye-bye.
And we turn our attention now to thousands of black people will descend on the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. on January 14th, 2017, one day before the anniversary of the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and 6 days before the inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th President of the United States, organized under the umbrella of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations. Now, to talk to us about the January 14th mobilization, our chairman, Amali Yashatila, founder of the Yahuru Movement, an African internationalist organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida, with members throughout the world, and also chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, and Lisa Davis with the People's Organization for Progress, and in this instance, the Black is Back Coalition. And I have to say that both Lisa and Amali Yashatila are fiery. They are uncompromising and courageous as leaders of the movement for liberated Africans and a liberated Africa. And it's a pleasure to have both of them on with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to begin with Chairman Amali Yashatila. We are, perhaps there are some people who might not think that the election of Donald Trump, who I certainly see as a proto-fascist administration about to be inaugurated, makes a great difference for people of African ancestry. But your thoughts on the matter and the conversion in Washington on January 14th, as a response to this administration, in any event, its purpose and its import. If you could begin by talking to us about that, and of course, Lisa Davis, chime in as well.
Well, actually, our response to the election speaks to what we see as the general weakness of the black liberation movement in this country that has come as a consequence of attacks on our people and our community by both Democratic and Republican administrations over the years, that it was a Democrat in power when Malcolm was assassinated, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and when much of the war that was made against the Black Panther Party and other sectors of the Black Liberation Movement. And we think that what this has done is to weaken the independent base of activity among ordinary black people, people who were subjected to housing project abuses, to people who are now experiencing gentrification throughout this country. These are just ordinary black working class people who did have organization and did have some element of power, and that's been destroyed. As a consequence of that, we find ourselves feeling extremely victimized by whomever it is in power. We got to remember, it was the Clintons that stuck 100,000 cops in the streets of this country that probably led to the assassinations of people like Mike Brown and Eric Garner and others throughout this country that we've seen so much resistance responding to. And now we have a situation with a Trump who is there, and we still find ourselves without the kind of organization, without the kind of response, coherent response coming from our community. And that's part of what the Black is Black Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, part of what our January 14th mobilization is all about. It's a struggle not to leave our fate in the hands of either Democrats or Republicans, but to determine for ourselves, this is the national black political agenda for self-determination that we have to adopt and that we have to fight for and that we take to come to Washington, D.C. to unite around so that we don't have the fate of our people absolutely in the hands of any political party other than ourselves, our own organized capacity. So the coalition consists of a number of different black organizations who don't try to use the coalition as a substitute for our independent individual organizations, but to adopt a general program that we believe is in the best interest of black people and empowers us, and it gives us the ability, whether we talk to Democrats, Republicans, or just among ourselves, to say, this is our platform. This is the agenda that we have established for national black political self-determination. And so on January 14th, we have decided that the inauguration of Donald Trump should not set the terms for the celebration of the anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther King, that we're going to make this powerful statement together with black people coming from throughout the country.
And Lisa Davis, if you could flesh out for us more of what the programmatic implications are. I know that there had been the ratification of a 19-point national black political agenda program for self-determination that was adopted at an earlier point. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the features of that that you are looking to rally people around on January 14th and thereafter to work towards?
Well, exactly. I can just tell you right now that the first 4 points of the declaration is the one on the first point is black women. We definitely believe that we must hold, you know, our women up. We recognize the contributions that African women have made throughout the world. And if we don't have a community that can strongly uphold African women, I mean, then there's issues, and we must definitely make sure that we uphold the black woman. But this is not independent of the family or black men either. So the second point is the black family. We demand an immediate halt to attacks on the black family, you know, to the genocidal campaign rooted in the Atlantic slave trade and embedded in U.S. public and private policy. This is very important. The black family unit is extremely important to our success. And when we see the breakdown of that unit, then we can definitely see that, you know, we can see the roots of many of the problems that we are currently facing. The third point on the agenda is black community control of the police. And we have clearly seen, regardless of whether you have a Democrat or a Republican in office, the attacks on the African community continue. And when we look at the history of the police, we see that the very idea of policing is deeply rooted in slave control and in crushing any kind of black resistance. So we definitely call for black community control of the police, with the operative word being community. We have the right to say who will be, who we choose to elect to police us or to provide any kind of assistance to our community at all. They have to answer to us. We have the right to hire and to fire. The fourth point, free all political prisoners. These are the top four points on our agenda, you know, of our 19-point agenda. So that right there gives you more idea in terms of the political aspirations of the Black is Back Coalition and what we stand for. But, you know, it's a 19-point agenda that we have adopted, a 19-point platform, and it is extremely dynamic. Point number 15 is about voting rights. We believe, you know, that we have the right to vote and to effectively express a preference for the political candidates. It is an inalienable right, and that we believe that we should have voting apparatus that more profoundly represents the community, you know, instead of this winner take all system that we currently have. So these are just some of the points of the agenda, but we definitely believe in black self-determination, and that has to be independent of whomever sits in that White House. It has to be independent of electoral politics, and we really need to reexamine, and I personally believe this, the position of the African community to electoral politics. We have to really examine that, and we have to examine our strengths and our weaknesses as it pertains to that issue.
And Chairman Yashitila, how do you see the major point of bringing people together in Washington on the 14th? Tell us about that, and then how you see using that to surge forward and continue the organizing process. And is there a point of departure between the Black is Back Coalition and other groups that have moved to the fore that you see, or is there an effort to create a greater unity among all of the smaller organizations that are out now working towards Black Lives Matter, in a manner of speaking?
Well, the thing is that we try to and continue to work to build the largest possible coalition. We think that what has happened, again, is that the assault on the Black Liberation Movement that led to assassinations, or mass arrests, and people are still in prison as a consequence of this attack on our justice struggle to win our happiness and the return of resources stolen from us as a people. And so we've established a broad set of general principles that all of us can agree on. And again, as I mentioned, this is not the coalition is not to function as a substitute for any individual organization, but to enhance the strength of each organization, making us more capable to pursue platforms than any of us could do as individual organizations. So, you know, we have principles around the question of self-determination, anti-colonial principles that opposed to occupation, military occupation, colonial terror, and what have you. And we were able to unite a broad group of forces around that, and principles opposed to the attack on Muslims and oppressed people. And we created a coalition also that deals with the question of peace, because we want to redefine what this issue of peace is all about. It's not just a question of U.S. making war in other countries, which is incredibly important, but even the countries we identify. Nobody talks about the war that's currently sweeping the continent of Africa, where in Congo alone, more than 7 million people have been killed since 1998 in these proxy wars organized around resources, in particular the resource coltan that is important to cell phone and computer production. We're concerned about what's happening in Haiti. Nobody's having demonstrations and blocking streets and stopping tanks from moving because of what's happening in Haiti, and I didn't see a single demonstrations around from the peace movement around what happened with Eric Garner in there in New York. Nobody's blocking police precinct vehicles coming to the African community. So we want to redefine the whole question of peace so that it's not just about a cessation of recognized government-approved wars, if you will, but it also is about uniting with the oppressed against the oppressor, because most wars that we see come as a consequence of the U.S. government in particular moving against countries that are attempting to strike out on their own, to take back their own resources, their oil and whatever other kinds of resources that have been filling the pocketbooks of corporations inside the United States. And so we want to redefine that. And we say we're open to anybody who wants to participate in that. But beyond that, we say that it's really important to say what our demands are. We not just say to what end is any of this struggle that we're involved in. And that's why it's so important for us to have come up with these demands. So any group that can unite with the basic principles of the coalition, we welcome you. We call on people to participate in this fashion. This makes us stronger, and it continues a process to repair the damage that was done by the assault on our movement that resulted in the murders of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Fred Hampton and an assortment of black leaders and destruction of black organizations throughout this country. So that's part of it. But let me tell you this. Our objective is not to rebuild the Democratic Party. Our objective, when people are out there and they're demonstrating in too many instances, and that we support all of the demonstrations against the incoming Trump regime that will occur on the 20th of January. But we're saying this. The thing is that we cannot be engaged in actions simply to oppose Trump, which in many ways say that we are for the Democratic Party, which in many ways represent an attempt by the Democratic Party to reassert itself as a dominant political force in this country that hasn't done a damn thing for most black people and most oppressed people around the country. So that's really important for us, to build an independent capacity, rebuild an independent capacity, to raise up all of these people and groups in these communities throughout this country who've been fighting, trying to take on these issues in isolation from each other, being ignored by the bourgeois media, and where we've had substitutes by Democratic Party hacks. And I'm sorry, I mean like Al Sharpton and the rest of them. And Sharpton, of course, I've learned subsequently, will be holding some kind of action on the 14th as well. We're asking black people to make a choice, to stand up, and let the Democratic Party, what is it, the old saying, let the dead bury the dead. We have a responsibility to raise up this leadership that's been out there, that's been fighting to resurface in an independent way to serve our community and not the Democratic Party. And that's one of the issues that we're confronted with. And so there are a lot of actions that we know will be taking place in January around the election of Trump. But what we are concerned about is whoever is in power, it doesn't matter if they do not speak to the interests of our people and our community, and of course if they don't stop these brutal wars of that the United States government has been involved in for the longest period of time. We are against imperialism. We are against the oppression of black people, the Palestinian people, oppressed peoples around the world, and we demand the right to be a self-determining people who can make a decision of what's going to happen to our children, our family, our future as black people, as people who are members of the human species. We do this ourselves, and that's what this January 14th mobilization is all about.
And we just have time left for Lisa for you to give us quickly the logistics, because we also want to cover an upcoming demonstration tonight on the issue of clemency for and freedom for political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera. So quickly tell us the coordinates of the Black is Back demonstration January 14th in Washington, D.C.
Well, definitely. We are organizing buses that will be leaving from New Jersey and New York anyone who is interested in leaving from Newark, New Jersey, they should call 973-996-8405. Again, that's 973-996-8405. And for information on transportation and buses leaving from New York, they should call 917-960-8530. Again, that's 917-960-8530. And for up-to-date information on what is going on with this demonstration and also with other things that's happening with the Black is Back Coalition, people should go to the website, and that's www.blackisbackcoalition.org. Again, www.blackisbackcoalition.org. We will be at the Freedom Plaza on January 14th in Washington, D.C., and our rally will be starting at 12 o'clock.
Well, and we're going to make sure. We wish we had more time this morning, but, of course, this is hardly the last effort of the coalition, and nor is it ours to investigate and find out more and draw people to support the Black is Back Coalition. So I want to thank Lisa Davis and Amali Yashatila, both who have spent decades organizing for self-determination for people of African ancestry and, frankly, for peace and justice and reparatory justice in this country. It's been a pleasure speaking with both of you. We will see you in Washington, D.C. on the 14th, and then we're going to find out how it went and the continuing organizing efforts of the coalition.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
It's entirely our pleasure. And we are now going to shift gears. We're going to connect with Emmanuel Melendez-Landero. There is a concrete example of international solidarity with the colonial case of Puerto Rico that is inextricably linked with the case of Oscar López Rivera, a Puerto Rican political prisoner who has been imprisoned for 34 years in the empire's prisons for his determined and militant participation in the Puerto Rican anti-colonial struggle. Well, as I indicated, we are joined by Manuel Melendez-Landero. He is the coordinator of a call to action on Puerto Rico, and he is preparing for an rally this evening for Oscar López Rivera, and we welcome him to the airwaves of WBAI. Good morning.
Good morning.
To begin,
thank you for having me here.
It's entirely our pleasure. And help make the case for Oscar López Rivera and tell us then why people should be at the rally this evening that is calling for his release. And Oscar López Rivera, as I mentioned, has been in prison now for over 34 years, and his case is intimately linked to the issue of the colonial status of Puerto Rico, which he fought against. So do tell us, and thank you again for joining us.
Okay, thank you again for the invitation. As you mentioned, Oscar López Rivera is a Puerto Rican political prisoner that has languished for more than 35 years in prisons in the United States. And despite that, there is a broad and energetic demand from the Puerto Rican people and the international community asking for President Obama to free Oscar by executive order. At this moment, the president has not taken any action on that regard. We consider that Oscar López Rivera is a militant revolutionary activist, is currently a political hostage of the North American government. It's been the case that he's a symbol of, you know, high moral and ethical and his consistent struggle for the independence of Puerto Rico. The government of the United States and its repressive agencies have targeted Oscar Rivera with the goal of breaking and intimidating the struggle for Puerto Rican independence, for the freedom. So, as you probably know, at this moment, Puerto Rico is becoming increasingly aware of the difficult, nefarious conditions imposed by the colonial reality and the capitalist exploitation for more than 118 years. So there is many possibilities for us to develop a liberation movement, and Oscar López Rivera is a symbol of the Puerto Rican struggle for independence.
We're going to go back and talk a little bit more about Oscar López Rivera and his case, but I want to make sure that we get in the coordinates of the demonstration this evening. So please tell us where you're going to be and to what end.
Yes, that will be tonight from this afternoon, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Federal Plaza building in Manhattan. Those are the, the federal government in the city of New York. So we will be demonstrating there from 5 to 7 p.m. Today, Wednesday, December 21st.
So I really
expect that many participants come from different organizations, for example, the Puerto Rican Independence Party, the Worker Socialist Movement, and a call to action. A call to action is the organization that I represent that is the one that made the call, the organization that made the call. But we are expecting many participants there with Puerto Rican flags, with our banners, and with our chants. Despite the cold weather, we will be there, and we will be in solidarity with Oscar López, but also making our statements of our determination to continue the struggle for the colonization and independence of Puerto Rico. The case of Oscar López Rivera is much linked to the actual situation of Puerto Rico, and as I said before, it's a symbol for that independent struggle.
And I want to encourage people, when they have an opportunity, to get book of López's, which has his letters and his reflections, and it's called Oscar López Rivera, Between Torture and Resistance. Really important reading. Oscar López Rivera,
definitely.
Between Torture and Resistance. In the 2 minutes that we have left, I just want to ask the difficult question. While I encourage people unequivocally to go to 26 Federal Plaza in Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, the federal building, between 5 and 7, to call for an executive order to release Oscar López Rivera, who's been held over 32 years now in prison, the FoxNews.com has really launched a ferocious campaign with Liz Peek as the financial columnist, who has written that this must be resisted. Oscar López is a terrorist. Your response? Why should Oscar López indeed be free? And how do we understand him as a freedom fighter against colonialism?
Precisely. Oscar López Rivera is a freedom fighter. As I mentioned before, Puerto Rico has been a colony of the United States for 118 years now. And it was invaded militarily by the United States Army back in 1898, the international community and the United Nations and the Geneva Convention recognized the right of those countries, those nations that are a colony, the right to defend by any means necessary to for their freedom, for our freedom. So Oscar López Rivera was and still is a militant and revolutionary. And in that sense, That's why we said that he's being a hostage of the United States government, because he represents the freedom movement of Puerto Rico at this moment.
We're gonna have to leave it there. I regret, but we're gonna do more next week on Oscar Lopez Rivera, Manuel Melendez Landero. We're going to see you at 26 Federal Plaza between 5 and 7 o'clock to call for an executive order to release